Hello, I'm Ivan Berg, and this is my story. Part 15. Fired again. A bigger family, a studio, sound engineering, and the Sunday Times. £5,000 a year, that's worth over 60 grand now, and it came just in time as Inga was pregnant again. Harry Vincent said we should get on the property ladder and that he would help with a mortgage. We liked the idea of having a larger flat, so we looked at a large four-bedroom semi-basement in Fitzjohn's Avenue with a huge garden for £10,000 with a fairly long lease. We made an offer of £9,500, and whilst we were negotiating, Harry told us about plans for a London Ringway elevated road that would go right through the property. So we pulled out. London Ringway never happened, but it was just as well we didn't take on a mortgage, as my salary turned out to be relatively short-lived. And anyway, Inga said she didn't really like the idea of living in a dark and damp semi-basement with a young baby. I found Muse premises in Rosemont Road, NW3, got Peter Cerrone to design and build a small recording studio and photographic studio on the ground floor, and an office and design studio on the top floor. I poached Jerry Taylor from Projection and Display to fit it out and run the recording studio, and employed a full-time photographer, Vanessa Waller, a friend of a friend. I hired a graphic designer whose name escapes me and bought a huge Humber Super Snipe estate car that was sent off to a specialist firm to have a camera platform and ladder made and fitted. Convinced that the world would be queuing up to buy Colourside sound stories, I went on a commissioning spree. 6 programmes on British wildlife with TV naturalist Graham Dangerfield. 14 programmes on the history of art with TV art historian John Fitzmaurice Mills. And 6 programmes on computers and computing with a computer guru who was my brother Michael's colleague at Honeywell Computers, Peter Friedland. Michael having moved on from Projection and Display to pursue a career in computing. There was even a range of Colourside sound stories for children, with puppets especially made by the Thunderbirds TV puppeteers. I wrote the first title for children as a tryout called Peter's Everyday Birthday. It worked, so this was followed by Jack and the Beanstalk and Cinderella. But the world took hardly any notice. It very soon became obvious that the setting up of screen, slide projector and record player was too time-consuming and complicated for Joe Public. A great deal of money was consumed. Undaunted, Shelley and I persevered. I invented programmed learning, aimed at the schools market using information on printed cards, and persuaded a few teachers to write the scripts. I remember the Common Market and beams, reflections and mirrors, but I'm sure there were more. A dribble of sales followed an expensive advertising campaign. More of Sun Alliance's 100 grand was consumed. Next came the Visison, a machine in a box invented by Jerry Taylor. This combined a slide projector and a Philips cassette player fitted in a suitcase-sized box with a rear projection screen in the lid. One of the audio tracks on the cassette player was used for a pulse that triggered the slide change. The device used a very small manual slide change Aldis projector with an automatic push-pull mechanism designed and built by Jerry using Meccano and driven by a Meccano electric motor. To everyone's surprise, 10 were sold to the army. I think they were impressed with the unusual use of Meccano. The Visison Mark II housed the works and rear projection screen in a big white fiberglass box. This machine was comprised of a Kodak Carousel slide projector and an 8-track tape player running on a continuous loop. The idea was to put the units in post offices and sell the slide and audio time slots to advertisers. The captive audience would be the post office queues. Great idea, but the technology wasn't up to the job. The 8-track tape kept snarling up and the slide projector overheated. I was running out of ideas, and so was the money. The Sun Alliance pot was empty, so we had to resort to a hefty bank overdraft to keep the company going. Arranged by Harry and guaranteed by Harry, Shelley and me. I was assured by Harry and Shelley that my signature on the bank guarantee was purely a formality and there was no way I would ever be liable. Anyway, I had no assets, so I signed. I also signed away most of my interest in the company. I think I was left with 5%. Nikolai Peter Berg was born on February the 6th, 1970. Inga then being in charge of the naming of our children after René's mistake with Sancha, which she said was the name of Rembrandt's wife. Rembrandt's wife was called Saskia, but we nevertheless preferred Sancha, which by then was on her birth certificate, with the middle name of Karen, in deference to her Danish lineage. Nikolai was also a Danish name, which he shortened to Nick as soon as he possibly could. Shelley gave him a solid silver birth cup engraved with his full name and date of birth. 6-year-old Sancha, having already showed signs of future academic excellence by the age of 4, by reading and memorising the day's TV schedules, had by this time graduated from nursery school and was attending the trendy and expensive Northbridge House private primary school. I couldn't help but notice that the Philips cassette audio tapes were starting to take off and were making inroads into the music album market. I had a contact at Atlantic Records who told me he was looking for regular short-run cassette duplication. I phoned around the record companies and Atlantic weren't alone. It sounded like a good way to make money and I wouldn't have to invent anything. There was no room at Rosemont Road for a cassette duplication factory, so I found premises on an industrial estate in Elstree. I organised the purchase of some American high-speed in-cassette duplicators. Each one recorded 6 cassettes at a time, and they could also be daisy-chained, that is, linked together to duplicate 36 tapes at a time. The business rolled in. I had found a market niche, and duplicating audio cassettes was, according to a delighted Harry, like printing money. And the company started to make a profit. Harry and Shelley then, without telling me, decided that what the company really needed was a chief executive. And Harry happened to know someone in his club who knew of an out-of-work management accountant who had been a chief executive officer for a mining company in Rhodesia. Which, of course, was exactly the right experience to run a cassette duplication company. His name was David Smith, and he was partial to Sherry. And I was fired. But I had a lifeboat. Inga and I had made friends with Annette and John Hales, who had bought the lease of the Rosemont Road premises from CIAV for their office and carpet cleaning company, Halion. And I quickly arranged a deal to rent the ground floor recording studio and some office space for £15 a week. I knew the leasing company that I had used to lease the cassette duplication equipment for CIAV and arranged to lease purchase enough equipment to fit out the studio as one of London's first four-track recording studios, with the latest TIAC 3340 four-track machine and two Revox two-track stereo recorders for track bouncing and stereo mixdowns. I ordered four AR-15 monitor speakers, two for the control room and two for studio playback. I linked together two Allen & Heath four-channel mixers to make an eight-channel mixer and set about wiring the whole thing up. It was all a bit hit and miss, but fortunately most of the hit bit worked. I fitted the studio with over a dozen microphone inputs. I wired up a 120-way patchboard, using up several reels of solder in the process. A friend who was good at carpentry, one of Sancho's teachers at Northbridge House School, did the necessary work in the control room, and I thought it would be a good idea to be able to do some short-run cassette duplication. So purchased eight Sony domestic cassette recorders and linked them into the system via my masterpiece 120-way patchboard. I think the whole thing, equipment arranged, installed, wired up and tested, was operational in 3, maybe 4 weeks. Oh, and I added a decent upright piano rented from Piano Renters Phelps. I then advertised 4-hour, 4-track demo tape recording sessions for £16 in the music business newspaper Melody Maker, and in no time started to take bookings. The only problem was that all the bands wanting to make demos only wanted to work at night. Apparently inspiration and musicianship only came after a few drinks and some puffs of grass, so I had to book sessions from 6 p.m. till 10 p.m. and then 10:30 till 2:30 a.m. So for the next year or more I saw little of Inga and the children. I went to bed at 3 a.m. and woke up at 11. Sancho was at school and Inga had taken Nikolai out in the pram so as not to disturb me. I did my family catching up at tea time, picking up Sancho from school and relieving Inga briefly from the demands of young Nikolai. Fortunately, one of the first groups who booked included Peter Moss, an accomplished, classically trained rock musician who taught me how to mic up a full drum kit, record the kit in stereo across two tracks, and then use the other two tracks like the Beatles engineer and producer George Martin, mixing four tracks down to two tracks on a Revox, then bouncing them back again to two tracks on the TIAC and adding more tracks. Invaluable experience for a rookie sound engineer. I also became very handy with a scalpel and editing block. Peter's band, I've forgotten what it was called, wanted to record enough songs for an album and had written some very interesting and tuneful songs about mythical beasts. It took at least 6 4-hour sessions to record, overdub, mixdown and overdub, adding track after track. The vocals were done by a couple of session singers. Backing and choruses were provided by Sancho and a few friends. And a young niece, Natalie, aged 4, learned and recorded, with impeccable timing, the midsection lyric of a song called The Unicorn, after extensive and patient coaching by Peter. The final album was never released commercially. I'm not sure whether it ever went to a record company. John, I'm afraid I've forgotten his surname, the band's principal musician and songwriter, died suddenly, and without him, Peter felt the band was not a proposition. I got the okay from John's widow and Peter to incorporate the songs into a story tape for children called The Lion and the Unicorn. We did release it as a cassette later on, and it sold a few copies. The new business just about paid its way, and the school fees, but it was obvious that it could not be expanded on the back of the 16 quid demo sessions. I modified the copy of the Melody Maker ads to include production and short-run cassette duplication, and almost immediately got a call from International Correspondence Schools, who asked for a quote to record a series of tapes to accompany their acoustic guitar correspondence course. My contact at Atlantic Records asked for short-run cassette duplication on a regular contract, and McGraw-Hill Publishers asked me to record and produce some tapes to accompany their shorthand correspondence course for would-be shorthand typists. I also started to record and produce more spoken word tapes. International Correspondence Schools asked if I could script, record and produce a dramatised tape by the title of How to Succeed at Your Job Interview, and I hired actors for the first time. I was also hoping to get some business recording radio commercials for the brand new commercial radio station Capital Radio. I had a call from an advertising agency that was interested in using 4-track for the first time, and I recorded the very first commercial for Capital Radio for Bird's Eye Fish Fingers in October 1973, turning a few singers into a large choir by bouncing tracks. It was very time-consuming, but the ad turned out very well, and I thought I was now in the radio commercial business. I suppose I was, but in a very minor way. The West End ad agencies didn't like to travel out to Finchley Road and preferred to use the Soho studios that were rapidly equipping themselves with multi-track equipment. Then came an odd one. The squadron leader of a Harrier fighter squadron by the name of Eric Smith was close to retirement from the RAF and thought there was a business in making and selling spoken word cassettes. His first and only title was How to Pick Up a French Girl, as the come-on title in a series of language tuition tapes. Fortunately, our landlord Annette was French and had an attractive voice. The squadron leader provided the script in English, and Annette did the translations into French. Annette voiced the lot, English and French. It was a lot of fun, with Eric attempting to produce indecisively, then handing it over to me. I think we ran a few hundred copies, causing our tape duplicator some hilarity in the process. I used my multi-track experience to good effect by adding music and sound effects after the voice recordings, and then mixing down to 2-track. I didn't realise at the time that I was actually pioneering the technique. I was even asked to demonstrate it to some rather snooty BBC recording engineers a little later on in our very grand and brand new recording studios down the road in Broadhurst Gardens, just a few yards from Finchley Road Underground Station. I approached my contact at EMI with some ideas for dramatised story tapes for children, and came away with a commission for, I think, 4 or possibly 5 titles. Of those, I remember were Jasper, a sort of early superhero who puts the world to rights, for which I wrote the script, Giants, Gods, Gold and Greece, stories of Greek mythology, which is still in our list for download on Amazon as this is recorded, and Mummers plays traditional English stories as performed by touring actors in the mid-18th century. One of them, St George and the Dragon, I remember being a huge hit with my 8-year-old nephew Daniel. As regular readers of The Times and Sunday Times, Inger and I couldn't help but notice the attention being paid to diet and fitness, and the weekly full page with the heading Keeping Fit Commando Style, a Keep Fit course designed by two serving Royal Marine Commando fitness instructors. I thought a cassette tape to accompany the series would be a good idea, and cold called the Sunday Times. I was eventually put through to Derek Jewell, the well-known BBC Radio 3 jazz aficionado, Sunday Times music critic, and director of special projects. And it was an easy sell. He immediately asked for a meeting, and our time with Times cassettes began. There were two fitness courses being published, one for men and one for women. So the cassette would have two sides, side one for men and side two for women. I hired an actress with what I thought was an authoritative voice for the men's course and a pleasantly voiced male actor for the women's course. All the exercises were rhythmic, so I came up with the idea of putting them all to music, using the songs of the two world wars as backing on drums and piano. So I had to hire a musical director, and it had to be done live, as the voices had to work in time with the music. So no chance of adding music later. I did use 4-track though, the drums and piano in stereo across 2 tracks and the voices on the other 2, thus allowing me to balance the music and voices later on a mixdown. Keeping Fit Commando Style was promoted in the Sunday Times and was a runaway success. The demand was far too big for our limited duplication facilities, so I had to look for a cassette duplicator. Obviously, I didn't want to give the business to CIAV, who anyway were in the process of going bust. But we couldn't subcontract the handling and dispatch process. This included the typing of self-adhesive address labels, fixing them to jiffy bags, putting the tape in the bag, sealing it, and throwing it into an open mail sack, which, when full, was picked up by the post office. Over just a few weeks, we posted over 7,000 tapes. We wondered why so many were going to ERA and Northern Ireland until we discovered from a small item in an Irish newspaper that the tapes were being used for fitness training by both the IRA and the Loyalist UDA. This led to a visit from Special Branch, and I think a man from MI5, presumably to check whether the studio was home to an IRA cell. We must have been given the all clear, as nothing else was heard.